Bonsoir, good evening everybody. My name is Véronique Bélanger, je suis doyenne adjointe à la faculté de droit de McGill et ça me fait plaisir de vous souhaiter la bienvenue ce soir. J'ai le plaisir d'organiser cette série de conférences de formation continue avec mon collègue Pierre-Emmanuel Moïse, qui est professeur à la faculté et directeur du Centre des politiques en propriété intellectuelle. Je vous souhaite la bienvenue pour notre quatrième conférence de la saison 2015-2016. Think Ahead conferences are focused this year on surviving technology. Tonight's lecture, brought to you by the McGill Center for Intellectual Property Policy, will focus on innovation and intellectual property. I now have the pleasure of introducing our three guest speakers. Our first speaker is Irene Calboli, a professor of law at Texas A&M University School of Law. She is also Lee Kong Chian Fellow and founding deputy director of the Applied Research Center for Intellectual Assets and the Law in Asia. She is a visiting professor at the School of Law, Singapore Management University, and Transatlantic Technology Law Fellow at Stanford University. Professor Calboli specializes in intellectual property and international trade law. She has extensively written in these areas, and her recent publications include the two following books, Diversity in Intellectual Property, Identities, Interests, and Intersections, published in 2015, and The Law and Practice of Trademark Transactions, published in 2016. Her current research addresses the blurring boundaries of intellectual property rights, trademark proliferation and non-traditional trademarks, the principle of exhaustion of intellectual property rights, and the protection of geographical indications of origin in the context of global trade. Tonight, Professor Calboli will present to us, her presentation is entitled 3D, Luxury and Disruptive Technology. Our second speaker is Richard Gold, a James McGill professor and founding director of the Center for Intellectual Property Policy here at the faculty. He is also Associate Dean Graduate Studies. He teaches in the area of intellectual property, including international and comparative intellectual property, innovation policy, and intellectual property management. His research generally focuses on the life sciences. Professor Gold has provided advice to several organizations, including Health Canada, the Ontario Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, the OECD, the World Health Organization, and the World Intellectual Property Organization. He has written extensively in his area of research. He has also filed amicus briefs with the Supreme Court of Canada on a drug patent case and at the Supreme Court of the United States on a gene patent case. He recently filed a brief under the NAFTA arbitration provisions in the case Eli Lilly versus Canada on patent law. Professor Gold's presentation tonight is entitled Innovating Innovation Policy. Ceux d'entre vous qui venez régulièrement à ces conférences connaissaient déjà notre troisième conférencier, Pierre-Emmanuel Moïse, qui est professeur agrégé à la faculté et directeur donc du Centre des politiques en propriété intellectuelle. Ses recherches et son enseignement portent sur la propriété intellectuelle, le droit des affaires et le droit des biens. Il est également responsable du programme conjoint MBA Droit en partenariat avec la Faculté de gestion des hôtels de McGill. Auteur prolifique, il est directeur de publication de la série sur l'innovation et la concurrence aux éditions Témis. Il a également agi à titre de directeur éditorial du nouveau Juris Classeur Québec sur la propriété intellectuelle, lancé il y a 2 ans. Avocat, le professeur Moïse a plaidé avec succès la cause Euro-Excellence contre Kraft Canada devant la Cour suprême du Canada, l'une des décisions les plus importantes des dernières années en propriété intellectuelle. La présentation du professeur Moïse ce soir s'intitule « La régulation des industries créatives ». Please join me in welcoming our speakers. Before we begin with the formal part of our program, let me make a few housekeeping announcements. If you haven't done so yet, please shut off anything that rings or buzzes. For those of you attending for the first time, please note that we are live streaming the lecture in an overflow room. During the Q&A period, students will make microphones available to you in the moot court. We have to insist that you use those microphones so that the participants in the overflow room can hear your question. There will be one break this evening around 7:45. During the break, those who need them will find washrooms in the basement. You can also get some snacks from a table manned by law students in the atrium. Tonight, the proceeds, the food is brought to you by the faculty's Kilometers for a Cause group, and all proceeds will go to the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal. Please give generously. In the next few days, you will receive an email with the attestation, your attestation certificate for tonight. If you haven't done so yet, please make sure that you check in at the table in the atrium so that we know you're here and we can send you your attestation. As I have mentioned on previous occasions, there is a change in the way that you will report your continuing legal education hours to the barreau. As McGill is now a dispensateur reconnu by the Quebec Bar, it means that all CLE activities offered by the faculty are offered under the same number, and so you do not need to add a new activity in your online record. You simply edit the original McGill Faculty of Law entry by adding the number of hours of each new activities at the faculty. More information is provided, will be provided on the attestation certificate. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to see us during the break. Il me fait donc grand plaisir maintenant d'inviter professeur Calboli à venir à la tribune.
Merci. Bonsoir à tout le monde. Je suis vraiment contente d'être ici ce soir. I'm going to speak in English. My French was good in the past. I'm Italian, but now it's not as good as to be able to present, particularly to such a distinguished audience. I'm very happy to be here tonight. I am very grateful to be able to speak about a topic that I very much enjoy, such as new technology, disruptive technologies, and how this type of technology can and will impact our legal ecosystem up to a certain extent. My talk will focus on something fun, which, you know, particularly for an evening, a cold evening, which is luxury. Often when we talk about disruptive technologies, we are going to hear very important patent, very important copyright, but, you know, luxury bags and fashion is also a very important industry that will be disrupted by 3D printing up to a certain extent. And what I'm hoping to convey as a message is that as much as this disruptive technology can make us puzzled, and our first reaction, and particularly the trademark owners, the company reaction might be, we need more protection, we need more laws, we need to ramp up whatever we have to bring more bullet to try to protect. Sometime it's actually better to wait and see, and perhaps the instrument we already have in the law will be sufficient. And very often, disruptive technologies can be an opportunity for new markets to be developed, to new jobs to be found, and it's really important not to overreact. 3D printing is one of those technologies that in many ways has created a lot of buzz. Not many people actually know what 3D printing is, what 3D printing can eventually be able to do, but certainly 3D printing can disrupt manufacturing as we know it, and perhaps not necessarily for worse, at least for consumers. So I'm focusing primarily on the luxury economy and the fashion economy. May I just have a poll of hand from how many of you have studied or practiced trademark law, and because I want to understand to what extent I want to quickly build a little bit of background. So many of you do. 3D printing, this is, you know, again, when we think about trademarks, often we think about luxury goods, bags, clothes, smartphone, and so forth. Trademark lawyers or trademark attorneys are often, you know, within the IP world, a little minority. We have patent, we have copyright, but in many ways, trademark law today interacts also with the other type of intellectual property, and there is many million-dollar industry in the fashion industry, in the luxury industry, not only, of course, you know, I'm from Italy, Italy and France probably still lead this field, but very much so America, North America, Asia, and so forth. So what is interesting in this screenshot, you can read, move over Jimmy Choo, how I made my own shoes on a 3D printer. Jimmy Choo is a fashion designer. I'm really not a fashion. I don't care so much for fashion. I care to study fashion, also as a behavior, is I think is very interesting. But the main question with 3D printing is, can we now suddenly 3D print things at home, and that will make the makers of product irrelevant? Tonight we're talking about fashion, or we can talk about luxury, but the same can apply for technology, for phones, for any product we might think of. The possibility of 3D printing just a couple of days ago was about molecular biology. That's how far our 3D printing technology can go. But so if now we will be able to have a machine in our homes that can personalize and print for us every product we might need and want, that can in many ways disrupt the way the current retailing industry works, the current manufacturing industry works, advertising works, and so forth. And so disruptive technologies bring a lot of anxiety to particularly to existing businesses and business models. This is a pair of shoes. These are the Jimmy Choo strappy sandals that fetch for 222 pounds. And now we can create something very similar. I don't know if you have ever seen a 3D printer. This is one type. I will show you a picture with different type of 3D printer. And now we can, you know, 3D printers are becoming more affordable to be bought also for personal use. But the trick is that the printer per se might not be that expensive anymore, but the materials to make the products is very expensive. It's very much like the laser printer might be very cheap nowadays, where the company really makes the money is the cartridge. And so the materials and the ability for us to make our product at home is still very much not there. These are some examples of 3D printers. How many of you have seen a 3D printer in action? In engineering lab of most schools now, we see them. Many companies, actually many manufacturing facilities do use 3D printing, for example. They are more and more used in the manufacturing chain. Not so much yet at the personal level, you know, from the individual consumers. 3D printing, the word 3D is really about layering. I'm not going to be too technical tonight, but the mechanism through which 3D printing works is input through software that then will be creating layers of products that builds the products through a certain design that will be inputted into the machine from specific software. 3D printing stands for additive manufacturing. The methods are primarily the additive manufacturing, so the addition of layers. We also have digital fabrication. The type of materials that we use in 3D printing is still very much polymers. So we talk about molten polymer deposition. We talk about material binding. I don't know if many of you have any science background. But when we think about 3D printing, we should not focus too much on the technicalities unless, of course, we are the scientists that build this machine and use these materials. This is like a castle produced with a 3D printer, again, with these specific polymers, kind of plasticky materials. Today, 3D printing can work with sheet of plastics, with sheet of metals. We can do jewels, and again, we can print them at home, but a sheet of gold is still very expensive. And 3D printing can print glass, can print ceramics, can print any type of resin, can print sandstone, rubbers, and we have even start to see human tissues, you know, used with 3D printing. These are, for example, some of the dental, so surgeons, dentists are using 3D printing because of the specific, they can take prints of our body, and then it can recreate personalized features for for their surgical and other needs. So the technology is really an excellent technology for personalize anything. 3D printing works through a computer that input data into a machine. And the very one of the key ingredients between quotation of 3D printing is software. For any of you who knows about intellectual property, we know that the most important part of intellectual property, patent, copyright, trademarks, design, it's to prevent others from using without our consent. Intellectual property, it's about ideas and how we realize we bring our ideas to practice. Ideas are per se non-rivalrous. If I write a book and you copy my book, I still have my book, you have the copy. But the value of my book or my work, it's in the fact that it is exclusive. If everybody can copy it, I still get mine, but the value of the work is no longer there. In software, I remember a long time ago when the diskette still existed. Now, one of the jokes is when you show my kid a diskette, they think it's a 3D print of the icon, the save icon of the computer, because they had never seen a actual diskette. I remember when the software were coming in diskette and everybody was passing it from one computer to the next, loading it, and suddenly the software company realizing, wait a minute, we are investing on software, we are going to bind it, license it, so we don't want people just to pass on the diskette, and even though we are just copying it, the value is really in the exclusivity. Software is one of the most difficult things to keep exclusive because it's really not a physical good. And the importance of software has been such that in the European Union, for example, we have sui generis protection for software. We have patent protection, copyright protection, multiple type of protection for software in the vast majority of jurisdictions in the world. The importance of software protection will rise with disruptive technology because while it will be almost impossible to go after everybody who might try to do counterfeited products in their home, will be easier to block at the source and prevent people from using the software. Or control who uses the software through contract, through licensing, and so forth. And these are just some of the programs that can be used for 3D printing. I'm a big fan of Star Wars, so the Yoda, and I've actually seen made, and I'm sure Disney might have some issue with that. Disney is the owner of the rights to the George Lucas franchise at this point. They purchased the whole package of intellectual property. As I said before, 3D printing is used in many industries, I would say in all industries, from medicine, for prosthetic, dentistry, architecture, to do the small replicas of buildings, engineering, chemistry, even in archaeology, art, sculpture, and of course the fashion industry. We start to see increasingly more a service economy developing over 3D printing. We start to have 3D printing, 3D scanning, the object preparation, the software designing, the finishing. And these are some examples, from the bike to some decorations, chocolate in 3D printing, and so forth. And Shapeways, it's another service provider of 3D printing. Here you see glasses, shoes, bags, pendant, jewelry. The world of fashion, like every other world, can be impacted by new products. Now, we might say they're not the nicest. I like the touch of the artisan. But the technology is getting more and more refined by the months. I wouldn't say just by the day, but by the month. And it's really interesting to see how more and more sophisticated creation can come out of 3D printing. I had a pair of 3D printing shoes, for example, fairly comfortable and actually not bad looking. These are dresses with 3D printing. Perhaps a little bit, you know, perhaps not Dior or Valentino, but still interesting, and it's really interesting to see what we can do, you know, with this technology. So what's the real challenge of 3D printing? It's not so much the fact that the technology is used in the factories or in the manufacturing to make the process speed up. The real challenge to 3D printing, to today's business model, is the fact that we consumer will be empowered to print things at home and do them as we like. We can like that specific type of shoes, but we really like them with a bow rather than with a square. We want them a little bit different, and we can tweak the software and personalize it. We go from a world of standardization, which is the world of mass production like we have today, into a world of more personalization, made at home, homemade with the 3D printer. And that is really worrying the big business that live on standardization, mass production, and so forth. This is from a couple of years ago, the Goldman Sachs. It was a report on 3D printing, and as you can see, the first title is 3D Printing Disruption Materializing. So this idea of disruption also being negative, something will change, something is disruptive, we will be the end of the world as we know, rather than embracing as a potential, something that can be good, it will have its challenges, but it's always a positive, the fact that consumer might be able to do things on their homes, we might perhaps diminish waste of our production, we will not produce more than what we actually need, and so forth. So as often happens with anything new, the first reaction is fear. There is fear of change in all of us human beings. The older I'm getting, the more I feel like my mother when I talk to my children. I need to really remember how I was when I was my children's age. I think that's a challenge that all of us go through. There is really a fear of change, so the message is 3D printing is killing manufacture and it's legal. And often this fear is triggered by a lack of full understanding of the technology. I live in Singapore, but I lived in the United States for over 10 years, coming from Europe, and even then you see a very different approach to Google. I mean, in the U.S., we don't mind Google. We think it's okay if they get our data because I can control. I can decide when I don't want to get the spam, but sometimes that extra can actually help me if I have a new information, if I have the keyword advertising, I want to buy Nike, and I get the keyword advertising that tells me that Adidas has a special sale. Fine, I actually wanted a pair of sneakers, now I can get them cheaper from Adidas rather than Nike, and I am better off as a consumer. Europe has a much more nanny approach, and we need to be careful because otherwise the machine is bigger than the person, and there is something true about it. But it's really interesting to see how different worlds see challenges and technology often, you know, in a different way. But that said, we see global manufacturing being really afraid of personalized 3D printing. Not so much on 3D printing the factory that can take away even more human labor so we can save even more in cost, but in empowerment of the actual consumers. So, first of all, some of these fears are over-exaggerated. Studies have shown, and that's a U.S. study, I think can very much apply in the same way to Canada. It's not going to be until at least 2040 when we will see a true spread of 3D printing technology inside people's homes like we see today, the personal computer. And so we are still fairly far from there. But businesses think ahead, and they want to, of course, plan, because they always live in this projection of profit and revenues for the future. Moreover, and that's absolutely true, even if, again, the technology develops by the day, there are current limitations on 3D printing in terms of quality and quantity of the products that can be made. First of all, the products have to be highly specific. The software has to be highly specific, so we tend often to have this pixelization effect. So the precision and the quality is not as neat as if my artisan does the nice piece of jewelry. It's slow. The machinery is not as expensive, but is quite expensive for what, particularly for a personal individual. And the materials tend to be either limited or also fairly expensive. And how many of us, including myself, would be able to print something at home today? Not many. We need to have certain skills that perhaps the youngster and the IT savvy people have, but the vast majority of us doesn't really have. And so in the sake and interest of time, it's easier to go to the supermarket or to the shop rather than trying to 3D print something at home. But it's also true that the price is decreasing. 3D printer machines were patented, and the first generation patent on the machine has expired or is about to expire. Accordingly, we will see more competition in the 3D printing manufacturing of the machine industry. We see smaller and smaller printers that can be personal printers. In Shapeaways is a printing shop. Like we can go to the Photoshop, photocopy shop. We can actually go, could be able to go to 3D printing shop. These are already out there. The price of services for due to competition or bundling, they can sell you multiple type of services is decreasing, and the type of services is increasing. So the diversification in the industry is increasing, and a lot of specialized product. I think nowadays nobody buys Christmas card anymore. We personalize them. We put our own picture. And so now we can 3D print ornaments. We can 3D print our kids' artwork. We can do personalized design. Perhaps, an additional gadget that can go in the birthday party favor that, then nobody cares for. But still, we can do things with these services that before perhaps we were not thinking about. And so, back to the first ad. Jimmy Choo, should you be very afraid of the 3D printing because now I don't need you anymore? What do you think? You still stick. And what if Jimmy Choo actually will design the software that you can use? And we'll provide you the sheets. I agree. But one of the interesting areas where all the luxury and the designer are moving, it's to personalize. The consumer want to keep to have the traditional unmade or quasi-unmade, and the one who wants to be the geek and want to have the Jimmy Choo software and mold with your foot that has been software to you, and then the sheets of material that you can adapt. And we will see fusion between branding as well. And it will be very interesting to see to what extent we will be able to do fusion ourselves, or designer will provide different combination through packages of coexistence agreement or licensing, cross-licensing that they will do. But I agree, these are still better. So it's luxury history. And I think the answer is Maybe not. Maybe the mass luxury can be history. But that was never really luxury. One of the issues now the luxury industry has is that, particularly with the big sales in Asia, luxury is becoming non-exclusive enough. And so we have to have higher prices or more exclusivity, and so personalization, the vintage, is becoming yet again the new exclusivity. Because mass production, or Yves Saint Laurent, for example, produces several, we can see some designer deciding to go, I call it the pyramid of luxury. Even Giorgio Armani, you have the Giorgio Armani design, and then you have the Emporio Armani, and then the Armani Casa, and then the Armani sunglasses that has a little tiny booth, not even a real store in the mall. And now you have the Armani Dolce and the Armani coffee and so forth. Of course, in theory, that's high-end coffee on high-end chocolate, but you see how designers themselves are really spreading thin. And some of the non-luxury item might be copied and others might not be copied. So one of the real issue with 3D printing is that 3D printing can make copies easier. And as much as we want to believe that Jimmy Choo and many other designers do everything by hand, they might do everything by hand to a certain extent, but a lot of the medium-sized company or mid of the way in the luxury pyramid, they're really not made by hand, they're made by machine, and they could be made by 3D printers. And suddenly, we could empower consumers to have in their own house the same technology that can copy, or a technology that can copy parts of products. And the real fear is, with disruptive technology, now we will have more fake products, more copies, more infringement in the marketplace. And the question is really, will 3D printer be the counterfeiter's best friend? And to a certain extent, I think this discussion is really mimicking a discussion that we had several years ago with a peer-to-peer technology. It's true. Peer-to-peer technology was, and perhaps is still mainly used, for uploading and downloading file for illegal sharing. But peer-to-peer technology, MP3s, it's really a technology that is meant for compressing files and data and uploading into servers and moving that fast, so then we can have a sharing of data information between, for example, company or legal law firms from one continent to the other and so forth. Back then, we have seen a lot of crackdown on peer-to-peer technology because of the fear of Napster, Grokster, and so forth. We are seeing now much less and much more attention towards the cloud technology, towards streaming technology, Spotify's and so forth, even YouTube. There is a lot of illegal activity going through these channels, but we know that that technology is actually very useful. So to demonize a old technology because of the potential to be misused by certain individuals, we now know perhaps it's not the best option because of the future market that that technology can actually open. In fact, 3D printing becoming the personalized fake makers at home can actually swipe away a whole industry of fake products. Those who are very afraid about 3D printing are the counterfeiters, because now they will become irrelevant. Now, I don't need to go and buy, you know, I live in Singapore. Singapore doesn't have that much counterfeit, but as soon as I step out, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, I think the only place in Bangkok where they're not fake is the airport. Everything else is just fakes, which is highly sad for the economies of this country. But now we will be able to print. I'm not interested, but those who want can print their own counterfeit. They don't have to go and buy it, and so that can actually resolve in many ways problem with criminality, money laundering, and so forth, that are really the channel to which counterfeiting product can come through. Some trademark owners, I'm not going to name any, you can see later, are of course calling for draconian measures. We need more enforcement. We need more criminal enforcement. Of course, criminal enforcement is taxpayer paid. As we know, custom enforcement the same. And so we need more, putting more people in jail because they're 3D printing, you know, Jimmy Choo shoes that are not original. It's something that might be questionable. Of course, because a lot of this activity can go through the 3D printers and will be very difficult to catch every user, now suddenly liability can become secondary liability for the manufacturer 3D printing, the software, and because it's easier, as several cases have shown in the United States as well and across the world, to try to go after the deep pockets intermediaries than actually after the individuals. Also from a public relations standpoint, you don't want to sue your potential buyers. Of course, the notion of what is an infringement can also be expanded. We have been seeing that in the past few years. And also we can see increasingly more proprietization logic across intellectual property. Now, in the United States, trademark rights are not property. Also, registration of a mark is not considered to be a property right. That's unique. In most countries in the world, registration is a property, but that's not the case in the U.S., at least formally. So these, of course, are the Louis Vuitton of the world. We need to ramp up enforcement. If you want to 3D print a Louis Vuitton bag, that will be, almost like a life crime. I don't want to make too much, I think there are issues with counterfeited products, absolutely, but often the manufacturer do exaggerate some of their claims. They think that everybody who buy a fake product would actually buy the real when it's not true because of price differential. It's certainly true in the music industry often because of the difference, the price differential is fairly low, but it's not the same in the luxury world where the price differential is astronomically more. And it's also true up to a certain extent that counterfeited, and again, I don't support that because of the damage they can do primarily to developing countries, but it's true that you see more innovation in luxury products and in every product, also because of the pressure of the potential copying. If more people copy, then you have to keep innovating and changing, and you have to differentiate in your product through better quality, because it is expensive for counterfeiters to do good counterfeited product. And the lower the standards of your genuine products, the easier it is to copy them. So to have good quality will prevent counterfeited, and so counterfeited products usually are known to be of lesser quality. Of course, one of the suggestions for the trademark owner is we need to put the marks really very attached to the products. We need to mix them with the products. So as soon as there is a 3D printing activity, it will be a counterfeited because it's an illegal copy. But as I said before, and of course, you know, I'm biased in favor of the technology, I think that there are real challenges to 3D printing, but there are also very good opportunities, and we need to be careful before saying that the technology is necessarily a bad technology. In fact, it's actually a very good technology that can serve society in multiple ways. So this is Public Knowledge, a colorful title. It will be awesome if we don't screw it up. Let's be careful. Sometimes we don't want to rush into regulation, over-regulation. Let's wait and see. Now, it's a good thing that the American Congress is gridlocked and they can't pass anything. And that's been the case for several years already. And because of that, we have seen probably some action and some technology development and some rebalance within the market as well. Of course, there is a genuine challenge in the way trademark owners can control scarcity. When I use the word scarcity, as I said before, if I have a piece of software and you copy it, you don't take it away from me. I still have it. Intellectual property is about controlling copying. It's an exclusive right. It's a right to give exclusive right to copy to others in exchange of either royalties or at least consent for free. So intellectual property, some I think is might say is property. It is property, right, because we decided to proprietize them, but it's also a regulation through which we regulate scarcity. We decide that throughout 20 years of the life of a patent, nobody can copy that product, even though everybody could copy that product or everybody that has the machinery to copy that product could, but we create an artificial scarcity through specific regulation. Now, if suddenly I have the machinery to do that, that might become more difficult. So disruptive technology disrupts the traditional way how the law is trying to control, in this specific instance, market behavior or business behavior, and so will create an additional element to disrupt this control of scarcity. Of course, from a trademark standpoint, individuals will be able to produce at will and to personalize and modify it. And that will create specific challenges also to the structure of trademark law as we know it. Who is the source? Who is the manufacturer? Is me? It's the software manufacturer? It's the owner, the trademark owner that designed the software or designed the bag and then give somebody ask somebody to design the software for me to be able to print the bag. We're going to see an increased participatory system through which the luxury brands or anybody creating technology, creating will give it first layers and then the consumer will personalize it. So we are going to have, it's no longer mass production as we know it. We can repersonalize, and so there is really a dialogue between the producer and the consumers. And the producer might find that some of the changes by the consumer are very interesting and incorporate them in their next design and so forth. So from standardization, we really are looking at more personalization. Trademark owners, consumers, now we have this button-down approach. We can start to see a little bit more two-way approach, because we will not just be told these are the products that you can buy or that's it. We can take them or we can just tweak and perhaps change that allow us to have more personalized work that might not be the same as somebody else, and that's perhaps is a good thing. In some way, scholars talk about democratization of the manufacturing process, because between the design to the actual result, you see more voices from the user. Of course, the luxury world or those who live in the Olympus of the big corporation don't like that. Anything that is democratic can become a challenge. But perhaps for the majority of the people, it's actually a step forward. There is no longer the possibility to control the message. We are often passive users of products that are given to us, and even if we think we want something, often we are made to want something, to want something through specific input by advertising and so forth. And we will be able partially to rebalance the dialogue. Internet has done already tremendous advance in that. We know through consumer surveys and consumer reviews what is good, what is not. Perhaps those data are not necessarily the best quality data, but we know more now about products than we ever be able to know before. And that's also a good thing for the economy. It's true. Because company might lose profit, we might see increase in cost. That can affect the work, you know, in the employment industry as well. So, And of course, here it's impossible to lay down all the problem nor create any solution, but are they solution, or at least shall we be careful not to rush into any too fast solution? And I'm about to conclude. High quality materials, as you said, Jimmy Choo will be there forever because it's excellent. So we're going to see more personalization, but also the excellent quality can continue to be sustained. What we can see having more difficulties is the mid of the way quality products. That's not perhaps a bad thing for the environment, for recycling, for many of these externalities that our mass production has. I think that we should accept the challenge of 3D printing. I've discussed luxury, but really this presentation is about all different industries that 3D printing can involve. We need to reconsider, also in a positive way, some of our business model and accept that they might have to evolve. The service economy is a change from a pure manufacturing economy, and so it's, our economy is changing. And personalization of products might not necessarily be a bad result. We can cut down waste, in particular, in a world, and that can tie in with environmental concerns, raw materials conservation, and so forth. And this is, for example, a Neiman Marcus pendant. It's a monogram 3D printing sterling silver heart. Just as an example, this is a Victoria's Secret lingerie. I just show the snowflakes. I don't show anything else. These are more, I wanted to conclude with that, more dresses. So from standardization, we can go to personalization. Luxury can become more a personalization, not just for the very rich few, but for more people. And there are already brands, for example, Barbaries and others, that are launching 3D printing integrated in their models. But as I said, there are some, and this is probably a little bit too technical, there are some challenges from the trademark law as we know it, particularly from a contract quality control standpoint. But I do believe that we should resist the criminal enforcement call, more responsibility for intermediaries. We should be careful about deciding that the law should be stronger rather than let the technology flourish. And here I conclude. Thank you very much.
So we have 10 minutes for questions in the audience.
Let me go.
Hi. My name is Mina, and I was really interested by your take on luxury and 3D technology. A few months ago, or maybe was it last year, there was a student at Harvard who used 3D technology to make makeup at home. And I was puzzled as to how you could actually replicate, for example, a NARS eyeshadow at home, because it's just so fine milled versus like Revlon or L'Oreal, let's be blunt. And what I found appalling about her attitude was that she goes, I'm going to target 13-year-olds who are going to make their own makeup at home. And I said to myself, 3D technology is not a bad thing, but I think you have to also educate people as to how it should be used and why it should be used. And if you're going to be targeting tweens who don't have fully formed brains, because their brains are still developing, and you're putting into their hands an ability to have things instantly without understanding quality, luxury, and the ideas that go behind the brands that we appreciate, I think that's a huge part of the problem. So what would you say, if we're not going to use the law to handle this issue, how do we educate consumers as to what 3D technology can do and what it shouldn't do?
I think the law that should not be used is intellectual property law. I don't think we should add any more responsibility through intellectual property law. I think you have consumer law protection, you have minor law protection, you have product safety protection that will prevent any dangerous situation like that one to actually become a business. You, under consumer law, have to go, if you want to use certain type of products in certain type of commercial context, you have to pass through FDA approval, you have to go. And so that alone takes away the problem. And so I think we have already the instrument in most of our laws without trying to criminalize or to increase dramatically the damages or the remedies for intellectual property infringement. I think, and just to make a comparison, to copy, and we know how the downloading happens illegally, and we know we have these draconian penalties. We know that in some countries work, but most in the more or less where they don't. But we got to the paradox in which to download 5 or 6 songs from Michael Jackson can trigger more years in jail than actually assisting Michael Jackson with euthanasia if you are found to be guilty, for example. So we have our system that has got out of control, giving people, in Canada we have a cap in damages, in the United States, for 1 song or 2 song or 3 song downloaded, we can have up to millions in damages. And if you are the father of minors to that through your internet service provider and addresses, you can actually be liable as well. We have seen the law going a little bit wild over remedies, rather than trying to have a better conversation with users, and that's not necessarily the best strategic attitude. And though that's everything, that's just really the only thing I'm saying. I'm saying this technology can be highly, potentially positive for society. To ramp up damages, to chill so people will not use it, is not necessarily a good development. And of course, whoever makes makeup and sells it illegally, and that materials can actually be damaging, that has to go under consumer law, absolutely. Yes.
Couple of issues. I don't see the environmental advantages of the 3D printing because it seems to me everybody's going to make more junk and it'll be personalized and nobody else can use it. And it seems to me that there is likely to be less environmental advantage rather than more. And the other thing as to the intermediary is, if I understand you correctly, your concern is that, say, the manufacturers of 3D printers would become liable for what people do with them. Well, of course, we've already had that kind of issue with the Betamax, with the copying and with the photocopier machines. And, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court, my recollection is, rejected these attempts to make the library with a photocopy machine liable for the photocopies which people make. So I just wondered what risk you see in attempts to make the manufacturers of machinery responsible for what people do with them.
No, I fully agree with you. I think Sony created a good precedent, and even the post-Grokster case now, at least in the United States, have created good law to protect intermediaries. But in copyright now we have the safe harbors in the United States. We don't have safe harbors in trademark law, for example. And it still goes down on a case-by-case basis by the decision of the courts. And as we were discussing yesterday, the real issue is not so much that case that gets litigated. You are all lawyers here. We know we are lawyers. We are not cheap. Our services cost, you know, a few hundred dollars an hour. If some intermediaries, particularly not necessarily the producer, but let's say the distributor, the person who has the printing machine in their shop, and they do a variety of services, from printing, and then they have the 3D printer, and then perhaps they do some makeup, or depending on the type of business, or they serve coffee, and then you can go there and read a book. Suddenly, a lot of those businesses in which they can provide the services, Spotify, the Shapeaways, and so forth, they are not producers. They are often small startups that try to provide a new service. They will find it very hard to be able to litigate. And so the reality of the fact that a few cases go all the way to the Supreme Court is that we see a lot of cease and desist letters sent out, and very few of those eventually, because people, the so-called risk aversion and chilling effect of just claiming that we have a right, and a court will decide the amount of uncertainty is still high enough, and the cost even of having a legal opinion to defend yourself, even if you are correct, and the fact that we often don't even have fee shifting, even though big corporation, we are looking at, one of the things we are doing is looking at the trademark bullies project, and we see that trademark bullies actually like fee shifting because they're going to add on the cease and desist letter, and when you're going to be found guilty, you also have to pay my lawyers. And so that becomes a problem. Of course, the world is not as black and want to paint it. I don't think a manufacturer nowadays will be found guilty, but service provider, we don't know, and they have to go through litigation. And in trademark law, we do not have safe harbor. And even that increases the cost, a lot of monitoring. eBay now have to monitor more than before, so does, for example, YouTube and many others. And sometimes they really err on the side of caution. When they are not sure whether something is legal or not, they tend to... Google doesn't care. Google has so many lawyers and so much money to keep going litigation forever. But the average medium-sized company does care about legal fees.
I'll just come back to the point about the environmental impact, and I can definitely see some of the negative aspects, but recently I had a blender, a little rubber gasket broke. I'd had it for about 14 months, so an otherwise perfectly functional blender became utterly useless because this little piece of rubber no longer sealed it. And we called the company to get it replaced, and surprise, this year's model has a gasket that's 3 millimeters different size, so it was still under warranty, so they sent us a whole new blender. And now I think, oh, in about 10 years, my 4-year-old will probably be able to help me make a new gasket to fix the blender myself. But then I think of product safety, so maybe that's not such a good idea. But it could, for... small repairs to repair small pieces of products, it could save a lot of potential waste, I think.
I mean, in many ways, it can open up an industry for spare parts that will be highly litigated because of differences and quality differences in products, like spare part for cars. But we know that many cases have been decided in favor of the provider of spare parts. I agree with you. A lot of people will print more junk. But... and that, again, it's not a 3D printed technology alone it can solve the problem of the world. It needs to go along with regulation. But it's also true that at a certain point, everybody has a certain disposable income. If I buy the mass market, I will not be able to also do the 3D printing, particularly if the 3D printing is a certain quality and a certain price. So perhaps when I have to choose whether I go to buy those shoes or I make my own because I really now like them, perhaps I'm going to make that. So it can also be that the amount of wasted product that get back to the factory and recycle or could be less. I don't have data to back this sentence, but they could be positive development, particularly if the materials that we can use are going to be strictly controlled. I think the individual... We as individuals tend to be more careful about the environment than the mass producers. They have to be regulated, and perhaps there is some really good intention business. But at the mass level, still what counts is profit and the real big pressure from market and showing returns on a quarterly basis. So I'm not saying that that will fix the problem, but might be something positive to think about, for example. So is a technology that can perhaps be useful also under that? Thank you very much.
Hello. I'm Richard Gould. Changing topics slightly, but in some ways overlapping, all IP scholars come at these questions from a similar point of view. So while we're talking about different things, in fact, you'll see overlaps. I'm only seeing half the room, the half of the audience that's paying attention and not working on their computers right now. Hello, the rest of you. Out of those of you who are paying attention even in this room, how many of you have any connection with innovation, industries, and so on? More the technology side than the other side? Okay, very few of you. That's fine. I'm going to try and make the rest of you excited about the topic. One way I'm going to do it is I'm not going to tell you anything about patent law, because that will put you to sleep. It usually does. And this is way past my bedtime. My kids, you know, usually make me go to sleep about now. So let me tell you up front what I'm going to talk about, and then you can go to sleep and wake up whenever you feel like it. Sorry about that line in the middle. Essentially, my argument is we spend way too much time talking about intellectual property and intellectual property strategies and talking about getting universities to transfer knowledge and do all these things. We just waste a lot of time because, fundamentally, it's not where the game is at. And I think that was a part of Irene's point, is that we just build up walls and walls. Great for lawyers. I tell my students this is a great way to make money in the future. But from a societal point of view, efficiency point of view, it makes no sense. The second thing is, and this is more particularly about Canada, we're really good at doing science and technology. We aren't necessarily the best in the world, but we're among the leaders in the world in terms of our quality of our scientific publications being cited, what our researchers do in universities especially. But we're terrible at innovation. And we're terrible at innovation for a number of reasons. One is we have no innovation policy. We never have. Canada has the only innovation in innovation policy to date was a couple of years ago when the federal government added the word innovation to our science and technology policy. So it became the science, technology, and innovation policy. But there was nothing about innovation in it, just in the title. But at least they acknowledged that innovation was something to care about. We also have not only failed on the innovation policy, but industrial policy, and I'll come back to that. But what we haven't done is, so innovation policy is about having Canadian firms like Google, who sell internationally, that create jobs, that spin off other industries, etc. So they're innovators and they sell internationally. But the other side is just as important, is we want Canadian companies to get productivity gains by adopting other people's technology. Great if it's Canadian, because that means all the dollars rest in Canada, but it's still good to adopt technology because it reduces your costs, which makes us more competitive. We do badly at both. Not a terribly good way to think about the 21st century when more and more countries are moving to innovation economies, when our prime minister said, you know, we have to move away from resources to resourcefulness. We're terrible at it. Okay. So we know this because it's been measured. It's been measured all over the place. And the stats I'm going to be using today come from the Conference Board of Canada, so a fairly reliable source, certainly not in any particularly left or right-wing part of the political spectrum. And their most recent grade to our innovation is a C, which is an improvement over D, but that's only because they measure different things now. If you actually look at what they measured before and what we do now, we would still get a D. They just decided to measure some other things that we actually do well at. This is really bad. This means that we are not either adopting technology, as I said, and we're not the innovators. We do not have the Googles in Canada, and we're unlikely to get them. Okay, let me start with the good news. I don't know how easy this is to see. Basically, the colors from dark green down to, looks like gray, are letters from A+ all the way to D. And Canada is actually fairly good on this. This is the public investments in research and development. So the federal grants to universities and other public subsidies. And you'll see that Nova Scotia has an A+ ahead of Denmark. Ontario is there. then Sweden, and then Quebec. So we actually put lots of public money into research and development. So it's not that our governments haven't been investing in innovation. They invest well and better than most other countries. We also see that we do pretty well in terms of scientific output. So if we look at scientific articles, you get Denmark, but then you have Nova Scotia, then Sweden, then Saskatchewan. They do a lot of ag research, I guess. Alberta, then Norway, BC. Quebec doesn't do quite as well. We're kind of middling. But we don't do that badly on an international scale. We're not the worst. And in some areas, we're among the best. But labor productivity, we stink. We're at the bottom of the C class. We're almost, as a country, in the D class. And if you look at Quebec, we are in the D class. That is, our firms are not productive. This is not because our labor force isn't productive. It may be, but not likely. It's because we don't use our labor in an efficient manner. That is, we're not adopting technology that would make every hour that we pay an employee generate money to the same rate that other countries, Norway at the far left, United States, and so on. Alberta seems to do not too bad a job, but overall, as a country, we do poorly. We also do very poorly in terms of what of our exports. So if you look at our share of the world market compared to everything else we export, we're way down on the right side for pharmaceuticals. Right? So Ireland does well, Switzerland does well, Belgium does well, Denmark does well. These are, in many cases, smaller countries than Canada, much more efficient in having companies located there that export. That's where you make your money, right? If you have intellectual property and you're exporting to other countries and gaining revenues, that's what feeds your country's economic growth. So yes, the productivity side's important because your firms are getting are more competitive in their product, but also if you want to have the Googles, you want to place here, or if you want, you know, the Mercks or the GSKs, etc. We don't play this game. And if you think it's just pharmaceuticals, aerospace, where Montreal is this great center, well, we're not as bad here, but we're certainly far behind France, UK, US, and Germany in aerospace, one of the areas that we pride ourselves, especially here, as being leaders in. And then let's move to electronics. Canada, again, is in the D range. So electronic products, BlackBerry and so on, we do badly. So if you look at the main areas of innovation, life sciences and aerospace and electronics, things that we think we do well, we don't. We have no global brands. We do not sell our products internationally. Selling in the Canadian market is great, but not ever going to generate high amounts of revenue that we need to be leaders in the 21st century. Okay, so why are we not doing well? Well, there are a few myths about this, and they're particularly frequent at universities, unfortunately. So one is it that, well, you know, you're not, it's not fair to compare, you know, on the productivity side, to compare Canada to other countries, or innovation-wise, to compare Canada to other countries, because we're a resource country, and resource industries do not use technology like other fields. So, of course, we're going to be lower than everybody else in terms of using new technology because our industrial sectors don't require it. The problem is that when you compare sector by sector, country to country, we do worse. So the same sectors that are resource-based in other countries have a higher level of adoption of technology and are more productive. So this is no excuse that we happen to be a resource-based economy, and therefore we shouldn't expect ourselves to be adopters of technology. Simply not true. Another one is, well, we're not entrepreneurial. Right? The United States, highly entrepreneurial, but the statistics don't prove this. The Conference Board looked at entrepreneurial ambition among Canadians, and we're high. Look at Alberta, BC, Saskatchewan is ahead of the United States in terms of entrepreneurial ambition. Quebec is a little lower down, midfield, but not, you know, we're just below the UK. And Canada as a whole is above the UK. So to say that that people here aren't entrepreneurial in spirit, that our universities need to teach more people to be entrepreneurial, simply flies in the face of the evidence. Let's do something else. Do they actually take that ambition and do something with it? Well, the answer is yes. We have new enterprises starting at a pretty high rate. Again, Alberta PEI, Newfoundland, Saskatchewan lead the pack. Quebec's not so well, doesn't do so well. There might be some reasons for that. But generally, we do well in terms of getting new companies started. So we have people that want to be entrepreneurs, and we have people who are entrepreneurs. So to say that we're less entrepreneurial and that's why we have none of these startups, we don't have the Googles, again, the evidence isn't there. Well, then the other one is there's no venture capital in Canada, so how are you supposed to start? There's this major gap. You know, we get this idea from the university, but you can't take it anywhere. Turns out that's not true either. Yes, the United States has more venture capital, but look at BC, which is just next to it, and look at Quebec. Lots of venture capital here. We're better than Sweden and Finland and Switzerland and many of the other countries that we consider as innovative. So we're not, we have the people, we have the mindset, we have the skill set, we have the access to money, we have some of the best ideas in the world. Why aren't we doing anything with it? Well, maybe our intellectual property laws aren't good enough. And there's certainly lots of complaints about that. But one could argue about intellectual property, and the three of us love to do that. But if you look at it from, you know, 30,000-foot level, our IP is pretty much world standard. Some areas we're below, some areas we're ahead. Even in patent law, where we're complained about, some things it's harder to get through Canadian system, but in other areas it's easier to get through the Canadian system than the U.S. system. Hard to say that we are below in an absolute way international standards. Even if you complain about copyright term, the difference is Canada's life plus 50, other countries give life plus 70, but that would be assuming that people are investing in software today because in approximately 100 years they're going to get a check. Not likely in an industry where turnover is 5 years. So IP is a red herring, and I think Irene made that same point, that our first reaction is, well, let's raise the barriers that must be our IP laws if nothing else is wrong. So let's figure out, well, what is actually wrong? I have to talk slower now. Getting too excited. Why don't we adopt technology? Why don't we innovate? And this is the place where, as a good Canadian, I'm going to say it's because it's not that the government has interfered too much. It's that the government has not interfered at all. This is a lack of public policy, that the government has not created an environment in which it makes sense to adopt technology, to facilitate it. Because while there are these rumors out there that knowledge wants to be free and people are freely copying things, it's really hard to copy stuff. Most knowledge is incredibly difficult. I mean, Irene gave the example of the 3D printer. If I were to give you a drug that you can make in your bathtub, and I told you how to do it, how many of you would be able to do it? You need a lot of other knowledge about how to do it, how to package it, how to ensure quality control. There's a lot that goes into it. Knowledge is far from free. To get Canadian companies to adopt technology, therefore, we need to provide them with means to do so. And then turning more to my area, innovation. If we want the Googles, It's not that we don't have venture capital and we don't have entrepreneurial ambition. It's not that we don't have knowledge. It's that we have failed to create an environment in which innovators can connect the dots to get a product out into the market. Coming up with ideas generates no economic value. Right? Universities don't create economic value by coming up with ideas. The economic value only comes when someone actually sells something in the market. And we do not have the complete skill set, the complete institutional structures, and so on, to be able to do that. And we can see evidence of this in how, in the lack of business investment in R&D. So I told you at the beginning that the public investment in research and development is amongst the best in the world. We have government grants that are among the most generous, certainly for companies as well, giving them tax credits, university grants, etc. We complain as academics, but we do much better than many other countries do. But business doesn't invest. Now, one could say, well, then they're just bad business people. But this has been going on for a long time. And so at a certain point, it feels like you're crying wolf by saying, well, it's simply because companies aren't well managed that they don't invest. Why don't they realize that putting money into research and development will make them more competitive? There's something else. There's something lacking that they know that if they put the money into it, they're not going to get the benefits because the things needed, putting money is not enough. You need the infrastructure around it. And this is just a sign of that. So what we have failed to do, essentially, is build an ecosystem in which innovation could thrive. So let me just give you a simple example about Uber, because Uber is an innovative technology. Like it or not, I presume if you're lawyers, you're not taxi drivers, so you aren't predisposed to dislike it. Uber is here, and Uber is going to stay. But you can think about, well, what kind of things make Uber more attractive? Right? So you can look at the whole issue about insurance. By regulating the insurance environment, we can make companies like Uber more likely to succeed. Right? Exactly what Calgary has done. Notice that Alberta was at the leading edge here. Right? Instead of saying, I'm going to resist technology, I don't want companies to invest and take up technology, let's figure out what are the roadblocks to getting the technology adopted. In Uber's case, it's the insurance issue. If we regulate that and we do it quickly, yeah, there'll be tons of disruption. The people owning the taxi plates will be out of business. The taxi drivers will simply move over to Uber. So there'll be some losers, but who cares, right? We're going to generate better service, higher quality, because we can regulate it in a way that will be much cheaper. So it's not intellectual property, it's not the software, it's figuring out what is blocking people from adopting the technology. So it could be insurance, it could be the right form of money. That is, venture capital is good, but maybe we also need money from banks. Maybe we need some money from government for different things. It might be that we're not international players in standard setting. That is, there are a whole bunch of companies out there that set the standards for communications and other things, and we just don't play that game. So our communications company aren't at the table where the international standards are being set. So they're not going to be set to make it easy for Canadians, because we're not there pushing our view about do it this way. The reason we're saying do it this way is because we can do it that way cheaper. If we're not there, we don't get to do that. So we're by not participating, because other countries are, they're investing in this. They go to, when the TPP was being negotiated, Google was in Ottawa and Washington, but also in Ottawa. Not a single Canadian tech company was in Ottawa. That's the problem. We don't have our government, we don't have others, thinking about how do we actually be leaders by taking on a leadership position internationally. So that's another failure that we have. And it's a failure that comes from the government. It comes from our leading business community. So if you look at the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, they're not interested in Canadian innovation because they represent U.S. companies generally who have a different policy orientation. Right? They're looking after their own members perfectly legitimately, but they're the ones lobbying, not the Canadian firms that have to unlock doors. So we don't think about an ecosystem. We just say, well, let's just give private incentives through the form of intellectual property. And what that means is that if I develop knowledge here at the university and I patent it, maybe for a couple of years I'll get a startup, and because we're a little bit overly generous in our subsidies, the Quebec government will throw money at me for a few years, and maybe that idea will turn into something interesting. At that moment, I'm going to sell it to somebody who actually has access to all those complementary assets to the ecosystem, because I don't have it here. So we take it from the university, we use public, so that, financed by the public, we move it into a private company financed by the public. At the moment it's about to make money, we sell it off to a U.S. firm. We've done that in biotechnology. We do that in IT. We do it everywhere, right? The dream of every startup from a university in the life sciences is to sell out to pharma, and there aren't any pharma in Canada. And so we keep losing out. And we pour more and more money, we're subsidizing our competitors to compete against us. That's what we do with the lack of policy. So we're making them rich by your dollars. That's the effect of 40 years of failure to have any policy in this area. And not only that is, we allow ourselves to be lobbied by companies who already have the intellectual property. They're already there. They're the world leaders. What is their incentive to create a regime to allow new entrants? Zero. But we are new entrants because we don't have the intellectual property. We might have once had it. We sold it. So if we want Canadian companies to succeed, we have to create an environment that they will succeed. And you don't do that by adopting the rules of the people who already have everything, because they're not, those rules are not designed to let you in. Right. Jim Balsillie has been saying this for about a year or more. But that's the problem here, is TPP, the CETA, all of these agreements are locking in intellectual property rules designed for leaders, those with the intellectual property, to make money. And if I were them, that's what I would do. But they're not designed for those companies who are disruptors. And I think Irene again made this point, that in Canada we aren't the world leaders, so we need to fund the disruptors of the world, the people who have completely new business models so that they can enter into it. But the last thing they need are more constraints, more barriers, and that's what intellectual property is. Intellectual property is essentially an anti-innovation strategy for business models. It preserves the status quo of business models, and it's anti-innovation for anything else. And that's why Irene was saying we need to resist it for trademarks, because we're going to impair this technology where most of the effects are positive. Some are negative, and we have to deal with that. But if we allow those that already have the intellectual property to dominate, we will never create those disruptors. So if we want Canadian economy to advance, we need to think creatively and flexibly, not only about intellectual property policy, but the other policies needed to encourage innovation. So Calgary with Uber is doing the right thing. Quebec calling for a moratorium on Uber is doing the wrong thing, because Uber's coming one way or the other. The question is, do we do it in a way that actually leads to us getting the advantage of it earlier and therefore have a competitive advantage, or do we push it off to a later date when we're going to not get the same advantage as everyone else? Just to give you a sense of what this means monetarily, you can't really see this. This is, I should give the the name of it. I thought it was there, so now I'm infringing on somebody's intellectual property rights. Anyway, a list of the top 250 information technology companies in Canada. So not surprisingly, Bell, BCE is up there, Rogers. The top kind of tech company is actually based in Montreal, the CGI Group, but they do consultations. They're not actually innovators in the same sense. Doesn't mean they don't get money. They get about $10.5 billion a year, so nice to have. BlackBerry has fallen, and these are last year's numbers, so they're even worse this year. But it still is number two in the technology company and the first company that actually develops products at $7.7 billion. But just a few years ago, it was at $20 billion. Now, the fact that our top-rated technology company, in terms of products, is quasi-in bankruptcy and is still leading the pack, because once you go below them, you're going down quickly to $1 billion and then under $1 billion, is sad. It's more than sad. It's indicative of this failure. And I don't, you know, we can mention Nortel. We can mention the Avro Arrow way back. Is it BioPharm Chema that was here? We can mention company after company that was at the top of the pack and then fail. So we could say, oh, they just were badly managed. But is that truly plausible time after time after time? After 40 years, shouldn't we wake up and say there's something missing in our environment and it's not the things we're looking at? It's not that universities need to be more entrepreneurial, because people who are out there are entrepreneurial. It's not that we don't have venture capital, because it's there. It's because we don't have the policies in place to get these companies to be world leaders, to have world brands. How many Canadian brands exist on a global basis? Almost none. So what do we need to do? So we need to think about what is blocking Canadian firms from adopting technology. I don't care if they're innovating, creating new stuff, because innovation includes adoption. I just want them to look at a technology and say, how do I bring that in-house and make it work for me? So that we are at least competitive with our U.S. peers. What's blocking it? I don't have the answers to this. I'm good at asking questions. On the innovation side, I feel more confident. But clearly, there's something missing here. And our industrial policy has been built on just extracting the things from the environment and not thinking about how do we become more efficient. And then innovation policy, which is creating the new Googles. We have to focus again on the ecosystem. What competencies are we missing in Canada? So when companies fail to grow, what is it that is getting in their way? Is it IP? Probably not. Is it insurance? Is it liability rules? We know, for example, that U.S. has done quite, one of the reasons the United States has done well in information technology is because of the safe harbor that you cannot sue a carrier for copyright infringement. And that gave them the room to raise money and, as a small company, enter into the field because they knew they weren't going to be sued. Is it freedom from liability, not exposure to more liability, that we need? So those are legal tools. There may be other tools, social tools, that we're missing. Do we have the right type of incentive structure for people to invest? Is it right to tax, for example, different forms of investment? So we had the CEO of Shopify over the weekend said, look, we were financed through a tool that now the federal government wants to tax at a higher rate. Is that the right policy? So those are the things we need to think about, is what is blocking each step. Israel did this really well. Israel was terrible at technology a long time ago. And the government simply decided they weren't going to be anymore. So they set up an office in the Prime Minister's office, and their job was identify barriers and fix them. So one of the first barriers was entry into the U.S. market. So what they did is they created partnerships with the U.S. and U.S. firms so that Israeli technology could then be delivered to the United States with that knowledge. Then they noticed they had a lack of venture capital. So the government came in and in some cases created the capital, in some cases attracted the capital to do that. They now notice that too many people are going, especially women, in the sciences are in the life sciences and not enough in computer sciences. And computer sciences per person generates much more income than the life sciences. So one of the questions they're asking, how do we think about our education policy that is discouraging women from going into these areas? Now, this has nothing to do with intellectual property law. This has all to do with an innovation strategy. How do we mobilize our people, get the people in the right spot? How do we take away liability where we have to? And so on. And then come back, as I said, step back from the policies that have been hurting us. Right, so the government of Canada a long time ago, and this doesn't matter if it's a Liberal or Conservative government, and probably not an NDP government or a PQ government either. They all do the same thing. They know nothing about innovation, so they all do it equally badly. We put a focus on universities patenting the stuff that comes out of us. We produce knowledge and say, patent it, and then find someone who will pay for it. It's the stupidest strategy that ever existed. Has failed for the last 30 years. So the response to failure, we're just not doing it enough. Let's do more. So we do more. We're just still not doing enough. Let's put more money into this. And this university is chief among those, where we keep throwing good money after bad at a strategy that has failed. Technology transfer from universities nowhere in the world generates more cash than it brings in. Most universities lose money. Now, they say, well, that's not our job, it's to disseminate. But if really the best way to disseminate knowledge is to make it exclusive, really? Can't you be a little bit more creative than that? But that's been our strategy over and over again. So what do? We patent our knowledge. Sometimes we have a successful startup. Then they sell to the United States. That's what we've done. Our university's been great at generating revenues, just not for Canada. So we need to rethink how we deal with the university, and you can do this for the different actors in the innovation environment. I know the university best. And that is to say, let's get away from intellectual property. What is important is you want, for example, since we're at McGill, to make Montreal the place that anybody who's doing anything in this field, let's say neuroscience, comes to Montreal. Well, how do you do that? Well, if I patent it and sell it, why would they come to Montreal? So what I want to do is create what's called sticky knowledge. Sticky knowledge is knowledge that's difficult to move. It resides in people's heads. It's know-how. It's contacts. There's a reason why Silicon Valley is more productive than the Boston area, right? People move around jobs in Silicon Valley. Trade secrecy laws are low. But what that does is it builds up a great mass of knowledge that are in people's heads. So there are a lot of people there, and they get employment. If they get fired one day, they'll be somewhere else the next day. So they're secure in being there. And you want their brains. That's what sticky knowledge is. How do we create it? Well, the British Columbia Cancer Agency found out a way. They provide cancer treatment in British Columbia, but they also fund cancer research. And so what they said is, we've got this vast database. We've got the physical samples, we've got DNA samples, we've got family histories. This is a gold mine for research. Now, the traditional way would be, well, let's find a pharmaceutical company, they'll pay us, and we'll just give them this knowledge in pieces. Goodbye. That's not what they did. What they said is, fine, you can access this knowledge, but there are two conditions. One is, you're going to work with one of our own researchers. So they develop knowledge that stays. Second, whatever knowledge is created through the partnership goes into our database that we can then relicense. So every time you interact with a private sector actor, you're increasing the knowledge, making British Columbia, Vancouver, a more attractive place rather than breaking the pie into pieces and selling it off, which is what we tend to do. So we need to have to think about how do we create those partnerships. And if you get rid of intellectual property, then firms don't spend a whole lot of time negotiating contracts, neither do universities. They can always complain. Most of the knowledge we produce, even if it's patented, has no value. And so we're economic value. And so we're spending a lot of time negotiating things at arm's length and blah, 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 rather than think, how do we restructure the relationship so that we can maximize the development of knowledge that is stuck to Montreal? And if we do that, then the next firm that says, I want to move into neurobiology is going to come to Montreal because the knowledge is there. And they bring their knowledge. And then the next company is going to say, well, everybody else is there. I better go there. Now, the Montreal Neuro is doing this right now. There are going to be 5 years of no patenting, and they're going to disclose their knowledge, which gives them the freedom to rethink how they do partnerships. Now, will they do it well? I don't know. It's still McGill University, and McGill University tends not to do things in a very innovative way. But we'll see. Maybe they will. And we know, and just to reemphasize the point, how am I doing on time? Okay, I'm fine. Most of what we produce here is far from what the products and services you'll ever buy. We don't innovate. We call ourselves innovators, but we don't, right? This is a misuse of the term. We create knowledge. We're good at creating knowledge, usually at the public expense, almost exclusively at the public expense, but we're very good at that. And our publications at least illustrate that. But what we're not good is innovating. So why would we try to hold, this is the theoretical part of the presentation, why would we try to keep that held tightly? We already have lots of economic evidence that the more widely available knowledge is, the more efficient we are. So we need to find a way to do that, and it's not through patents. So we need to stop thinking about teaching entrepreneurship. One of the in things at McGill, we talk about we need to teach people to be entrepreneurial. Actually, we don't. They're already entrepreneurial, and the last people you want them to teach to be entrepreneurial are professors who have gone into academia partially because they weren't entrepreneurial. We do some things well. We're sometimes somewhat a little bit innovative in terms of teaching, so there we're good. But we're bureaucratic. Like, when the neuro wants to go open science, it's not like the CEO and senior executive say, okay, we're going open science, we're convinced. No. You got to spend about 2 years consulting with everybody to get to the point everybody knew you were going to get to. And then you have to go through McGill. And McGill, again, is going to say, no, that's too scary. We're going to scare our funders by saying we're not going to get patents. So let's put in, which was what they're doing, a $30 million fund to do the traditional stuff so it doesn't look so bad. Let's hide our innovative approach to innovation by doing the traditional thing. So why would anybody think that a university is going to teach entrepreneurship or innovation? We're just terrible. Luckily, people out there are good at it. We just have to find them. We just have to talk to them and figure out what are the actual barriers to their being successful. If not, we'll continue to do what we do. We'll believe that the myths that simply aren't true are true, that we're not entrepreneurial, that there's something different about our industrial sectors than other countries. Or we'll believe that, well, it works in the United States, which has a completely different ecosystem, so it will work here just the same. Well, that's just not true. Never has been. We don't have access to the same regulations. We don't have access to money in the same way. Some of that is really good. That's how, by not being innovative, we avoided some of the worst parts of the 2008 downturn. But in other respects, we're not as good. And particularly, we don't play on the world stage. If something is going to block us, it's we're not there. We sign up to international agreements like the TPP that are made for companies that already have IP. But we're not there lobbying constantly in Brussels and in Washington and the other capitals where the actual decisions about what the technology environment is going to look like happens. And if we're not there, we're out of luck. So we have a choice. We either have an innovation policy and that actually addresses what's missing, identifies the gaps, tries to flexibly deal with them. Israel didn't go in and say, oh, I know, these are the three things, I'm only going to do these three things. They just said, we're going to be innovators. What's the first roadblock? Fix it. What's the next roadblock? Fix it. There is no one strategy you can map out today that you can carry on a 10-year plan. What you can do is have a commitment by senior levels of government that they're going to do something about this, whatever it takes. Until then, we're going to continue to decline as innovators. Our industries will continue to be less productive than the future, than our competitors. And as we've seen with oil prices slumping and other natural resources slumping, we're vulnerable to all the problems of the 18th century when we should be, given our entrepreneurial spirit and our knowledge, the leaders of the 21st. Thank you. The other innovation is you're not allowed to ask me questions till after he speaks.
Rochelle, comment ça va la business? And the tips? The tips are good? I'm the last one. That's the worst spot. So you have mini exams? So this is the end of. Eighth grade. One semester.
Je vous donne.
Il y a quelqu'un.
Allô, allô. On va reprendre, s'il vous plaît.
Not sure. Well, say not sure.
Bonsoir à tous. Je suis la dernière marche avant le trophée final. Qui est l'attestation. Je suis la dernière porte avant la lumière. Je vois que Richard Gold vous a mis dans une bonne humeur. Il y a des sourires et des rires. Alors je vais vous emmener dans une place d'une partie de notre recherche au centre de recherche en politique des propriétés intellectuelles avec un titre un peu provocateur, Who Owns Your Brain, puisque la valeur actuelle, ce n'est plus tellement les produits, les inventions, les œuvres, mais en réalité, tel que vous l'a expliqué professeur Gold, c'est bien la capacité de créer, et cette capacité de créer, elle est dans l'individu, elle est par essence humaine. C'est l'individu qui devient la valeur, et le marché, la guerre pour les cerveaux a démarré il y a bien longtemps. Et pour parler d'innovation, il faut parler de cette lutte pour les talents et pour les cerveaux. Alors, la créativité, c'est ce qui est au cœur de l'innovation, et le juriste participe à réfléchir comment, par les normes qu'il établit, comment il peut provoquer cette étincelle de génie, comment il peut retenir cette valeur, qui est la créativité, comment elle s'exprime, dans quelle mesure ces normes peuvent avoir un effet sur cette créativité. Mais dès lors que l'on pense à l'individu, au cerveau, à cette créativité, eh bien, on s'aperçoit très vite que l'ensemble des phénomènes créatifs sont le fait des institutions qu'on appelle des corporations ou même des universités, c'est-à-dire qu'on ne crée jamais seul, on ne crée pas dans un vacuum, mais en réalité on crée à plusieurs, et on sait très bien que c'est par la circulation du savoir que l'on obtient un très haut niveau de créativité, et donc éventuellement on optimise nos chances à l'innovation. Vous ne serez pas surpris de savoir que certaines études qui ont été menées en Allemagne il y a déjà une dizaine d'années démontrent que dans les plus grandes entreprises allemandes, uniquement 20%, et ça ce sont des chiffres d'il y a une dizaine d'années, 20% des inventions, et là je fais l'équation un peu simplistique entre innovation et invention, mais simplement 20% des inventions sont le fait d'inventeurs individuels. En réalité, 80% du phénomène créatif qui s'exprime à travers une invention est le produit d'une recherche collective et d'une collaboration créative. Donc, dès lors qu'on pense à travers la notion de créativité, on ouvre vers un tout autre domaine d'investigation. On est dans un domaine d'investigation qui nous amène hors de la propriété intellectuelle, ou en tout cas nous amène à réfléchir la propriété intellectuelle dans son effet, dans son impact sur cette créativité. Et en réalité, très vite, et mes collègues avant moi j'avais une petite image là. Alors le blanc au milieu de la diapositive, c'était une ampoule. D'accord. Alors cette créativité, en fait, lorsqu'on pense, on essaie de la saisir à travers les règles de propriété intellectuelle, eh bien, on ne la saisit pas très bien. Pourquoi ? Parce que la propriété intellectuelle concerne et s'occupe essentiellement de créer des biens, créer des properties, des biens intellectuels. Or, la créativité est du domaine plus de l'idée et pas des fruits de l'idée. Les fruits de l'idée, eux, vont être saisis à partir des règles de propriété intellectuelle, mais tout ce qui fait la valeur cérébrale, la valeur qui relève de l'expérience, qui est désormais valorisée, est du domaine de l'expérience, du domaine du savoir-faire. Et à cela, la propriété intellectuelle ne permet pas de saisir, ou en tout cas ce n'est pas un domaine qui la concerne directement. Certaines recherches ont montré, en parlant des brevets d'invention, que le mémoire descriptif qui décrit l'invention, qui explique comment reproduire l'invention, capture une partie du cerveau de l'inventeur. Ce sont des théories plutôt nouvelles, plutôt originales, qui sont toutefois pas tout à fait convaincantes. Donc, quand on cherche, on réfléchit en termes de créativité, que l'on applique notre regard de juriste et notamment notre regard de spécialiste en propriété intellectuelle, on peut s'interroger, est-ce que le mémoire descriptif permet de saisir, de retenir le produit du cerveau de l'inventeur? Certains vont vous dire oui, mais on est très peu convaincus. Oui, il y a une certaine forme de savoir qui est dans le mémoire descriptif, qui fait partie de l'invention, du comment on reproduit l'invention, mais c'est assez limitatif. L'innovation est bien plutôt une question de mobilité du savoir, et c'est les dernières recherches que l'on a menées au centre, et c'est un mouvement qui est venu des sciences politiques. On a fait savoir que, en réalité, c'était avec la circulation des cerveaux, et donc le cerveau ne va pas sans les bras et les jambes, c'est-à-dire que le cerveau va avec la circulation de l'employé à l'intérieur des firmes et entre les firmes, que l'on atteint un haut niveau de créativité et un haut niveau de création. Et en réalité, encore une fois, quand on s'interroge à ces grands thèmes, c'est bien plutôt la circulation des employés, le statut des employés qui nous concerne ici, plus que la création des produits. Oui, la création des produits capture la valeur, elle permet, puisque par définition une propriété est un bien, elle permet la transaction, mais en amont, pour avoir ce produit et pour avoir ce meilleur produit, ce produit qui permet de se distinguer en termes de performance et de prix, il faut la créativité, et c'est là que l'on va avoir des réflexions sur l'employé. Et c'est assez étonnant parce que dès lors qu'on commence à fouiller un peu l'articulation, en tout cas l'impact ou les effets de la propriété intellectuelle avec cette question de créativité, qui n'est pas une norme légale, qui n'est pas un concept juridique, on arrive à comprendre sa propre matière comme un verrou. Et en réalité, il y a un double verrou qui apparaît très rapidement. Encore une fois, j'avais mis un double verrou, une petite image qui me permettait d'avoir un petit coloré, mais qui n'apparaît pas. Double verrou, pourquoi? Eh bien, parce que l'employé qui crée au sein d'une institution, souvent, n'est pas le propriétaire de la propriété intellectuelle qu'il génère. Alors, c'est assez dommage pour ceux qui voyaient dans le mécanisme de propriété intellectuelle le mécanisme de l'innovation, puisqu'on ne va pas dire que l'employé innovateur va créer pour la propriété, puisque la propriété est directement transférée à l'employeur. Donc très rapidement, on voit tout de suite que dans ce mécanisme qu'on appelle aux États-Unis les work for hire, on a l'argument principal de contestation qui nous permet de dire, eh bien, la propriété intellectuelle n'est certainement pas l'incitatif le plus performant si on pense que, et si l'on constate que l'employé, de toutes les manières, sera dépossédé de ce qu'il va créer. Et c'est particulièrement vrai dans le cadre du droit d'auteur, où il y a une dépossession, où il y a une continuation de la personne du créateur dans l'œuvre. Mais même dans ce cas-là, il est dépossédé de son œuvre au profit de l'entreprise qu'il a embauchée. Et dès lors qu'on commence à penser en termes de verrou, que l'on regarde comment la propriété intellectuelle est utilisée dans les contrats d'emploi, eh bien, voisine à la clause de propriété intellectuelle, on trouve la clause de non-concurrence. Et là, il s'agit plus de penser en termes de verrou, mais de double verrou. Parce que non seulement l'employé créateur, innovateur est dépossédé de sa propriété intellectuelle, mais en plus de ça, s'il avait des velléités de faire circuler son cerveau ailleurs que dans l'entreprise, on l'en empêche par des clauses de non-concurrence qui ajoutent un coût et qui sanctionnent le fait d'aller travailler pour un autre employeur. Alors très tôt, je ne sais pas pourquoi mes images n'apparaissent pas, c'est dommage, très tôt on s'est aperçu, et ce sont les politologues qui nous ont lancé l'hypothèse qui est un défi pour le juriste, qui est la suivante. On observe que dans les districts ou dans les régions où il n'y a pas de clause de non-concurrence, où les clauses de non-concurrence sont déclarées invalides, ou ne peuvent pas être mises en vigueur, eh bien, ce sont des régions qui ont un très haut taux de créativité et un très haut taux de circulation inter et intra-firme dans des domaines donc de haute technologie. Et c'est particulièrement le cas pour la Silicon Valley. Basée en Californie, en réalité, la loi de Californie interdit la mise en œuvre des clauses de non-concurrence dans les contrats d'emploi. Alors, les politologues ont très vite associé cette incapacité à retenir le cerveau avec un très haut rendement de mobilité, un très haut taux de mobilité à l'intérieur d'une région. Et c'est en ayant cet employé enrichi par ses diverses expériences qu'il cumule des savoirs, des expériences, une connaissance qui va généralement amener une plus-value pour la région même. Et ça crée un effet boule de neige, ça crée un effet d'attraction. Puisque l'on est dans le mouvement, ce mouvement a sa propre synergie. Ce mouvement, c'est un mouvement d'immigration. C'est un mouvement où l'employé devient véritablement la valeur, l'employé spécialisé, le cerveau devient la valeur, le talent devient la valeur, et crée un pool attractif, un épicentre du facteur géopolitique de l'innovation. Et dans un ouvrage que Annalise Saxonian, qui est une politologue, a publié il y a quelques années, elle appelait ce mouvement de circulation des employés à l'intérieur d'une région, mais également au niveau global, « The New Argonaut », se référant à un texte mythologique où the Greeks who sailed with Jason in search of golden fleece, the new Argonauts, foreign-born, technically skilled entrepreneurs who traveled back and forth between Silicon Valley and their home countries, seek their fortune in distant lands by launching companies far from established centers of skill and technology. Ces hypothèses qui nous sont données par les politologues ont été également vérifiées dans d'autres régions, notamment en Israël, où l'un des vecteurs principaux de l'innovation, lorsqu'on a réfléchi à des politiques de l'innovation, a été l'immigration. On s'est aperçu qu'en réalité, le mouvement des employés qualifiés à l'intérieur d'Israël et à l'extérieur, avec une circulation internationale souvent liée à de l'éducation que l'on avait acquise à l'extérieur du pays, était un facteur déterminant pour avoir un pool de créativité qui permettait en amont d'obtenir un très haut taux d'innovation. Donc l'immigration est clé. L'immigration parfois sélective, l'immigration de talents est clé dans le discours sur l'innovation. C'est assez intéressant parce que pour un spécialiste en propriété intellectuelle, on a changé d'objet. On n'est plus à examiner ce qu'est une œuvre, on n'est plus à examiner ce qu'est une marque de commerce, on n'est plus à examiner ce qu'est une invention, on se prend à examiner un autre objet qui est l'employé, qui est le cerveau. Et c'est aussi intéressant parce que d'autres secteurs de la science, et notamment les neurosciences, s'intéressent également à la valeur intrinsèque du cerveau, vous le savez. Mais il y a également d'autres secteurs des sciences humaines, qui s'intéressent au développement du cerveau. C'est la neuroéconomie, qui se développe également comme une science à part. Désormais, et vous n'avez plus l'image ici, mais il y a eu une étude qui a été rendue il y a très peu de temps, c'est dommage que vous ne l'ayez pas, qui a eu comme objet d'étude le joueur de football Messi. Et la conclusion de ce savant rapport, c'était que la qualité de joueur de Messi n'était pas due à ses capacités physiques, qui étaient par ailleurs très médiocres, mais à sa capacité, à la rapidité, à la célérité à laquelle il prenait des décisions de jeu. Il y a donc toute une science de l'économie, de la neuroéconomie, qui essaie d'examiner quelles sont les conditions dans lesquelles on crée, dans les conditions dans lesquelles on prend nos décisions, et bien entendu, ce qui nous amène à acheter différents types de produits, différentes formes, différentes couleurs, etc., c'est-à-dire quels sont les stimulants qui fonctionnent sur nos cerveaux. Alors, l'objet de notre recherche à McGill, c'est véritablement les cerveaux comme une autre forme de propriété. Dans quelle mesure le cerveau, le talent, l'employé concernent le droit? Alors, notre première station, notre premier plan de recherche, c'est bien entendu de quelle manière ce cerveau qui a des mains et des jambes peut être amené à être retenu comme valeur, comme propre valeur dans une entreprise, et ce qui nous force à examiner les employés créatifs et l'application des clauses de non-concurrence. On a bien entendu dans le Code civil du Québec, comme ailleurs, des limitations quant à la validité des clauses de non-concurrence entre un employeur et son employé. C'est l'article 20-89 qui énonce les conditions de base de la validité de ces clauses. La clause de non-concurrence, un petit peu comme ce qui se passe dans le reste du Canada, est valide uniquement si elle est limitée quant à sa nature, quant au temps. Il ne faut pas qu'elle dépasse un certain nombre d'années, sinon elle risque d'être annulée par les cours, et il faut qu'elle soit délimitée également géographiquement. Donc, il y a un certain nombre de conditions quant à la validité de ces clauses, mais ces clauses sont présumées valides. Et on va voir, non seulement elles sont présumées valides, alors que d'autres pays commencent à douter clairement de leurs fonctions et de leurs utilités, mais non seulement elles demeurent valides au Québec, mais il y a un regain, un zèle particulier des cours québécoises quant à l'opposition de clauses de non-concurrence à des employés créatifs. En réalité, si aujourd'hui vous deviez faire valider une clause de non-concurrence au Québec, vous auriez un taux de réussite relativement élevé. La Cour supérieure du Québec est relativement attentive à ce type de disposition contractuelle, et les dernières clauses qu'on aura l'occasion de discuter le prouvent amplement. Alors, on a ces dispositions, on a un encadrement, il faut quand même que cette clause elle soit raisonnable, mais cette clause est présumée valide. Bien entendu, il y a dans les conditions d'application de ces clauses de non-concurrence, il y a des éléments de politique législative. Bien entendu, c'est la liberté de l'employé, c'est la liberté de trouver du travail qui est ici engagée. Et dans de nombreuses causes, il y a des discussions devant les tribunaux quant à la raisonnabilité de la clause, l'impact de valider la clause et de l'imposer à l'employé, l'impact que ça peut avoir personnellement et professionnellement sur l'employé qui se voit opposer la clause qu'il a signée. L'employeur ne peut empêcher l'employé d'utiliser, même au profit d'un concurrent, ses aptitudes, sa compétence et sa capacité intellectuelle. Il ne peut non plus lui interdire d'utiliser la formation et les connaissances qu'il a pu acquérir au sein de son entreprise. Ce thème, cet argument, est souvent discuté en cours et c'est véritablement le lieu de toutes les discussions. Dans quelle mesure une entreprise qui a payé pour une formation de l'employé peut retenir ce savoir qu'on appelle la connaissance tacite, c'est-à-dire une connaissance qui n'est pas exprimée dans des mots, qui ne peut pas être capturée à partir d'une liste de clients, qui ne peut pas être matérialisée dans ce qu'on appelle des secrets commerciaux, mais bien un savoir beaucoup moins définissable, un savoir qui est beaucoup plus de l'expérience, de la nature de l'expérience, qui est impalpable, mais qui fait la valeur de l'employé clé. Toute la discussion est là. De quelle manière est-ce que c'est une bonne politique législative que de permettre à une entreprise de retenir l'employé pour l'accumulation de savoir qu'il a acquis durant l'emploi et qui est nécessaire à sa profession ? Il y a des tensions donc nécessaires, des tensions évidentes entre l'intérêt de l'employeur, de l'entreprise qui a payé, qui a financé une partie de cette formation, et bien entendu la liberté de circulation et la possibilité de l'employé de trouver un emploi. Je vous amène maintenant, après avoir posé les grands termes de la discussion, je vous amène maintenant dans la réalité des cours québécoises et de quelques exemples que l'on a eus récemment et qui nous amènent tout de suite dans un milieu innovant, un milieu de l'industrie créative qui est Ubisoft. En réalité, Ubisoft a fait beaucoup pour le droit des clauses de non-concurrence très récemment. Et vous allez voir que ça pose problème. Ça pose problème parce que, et je vais le redire un peu plus loin, parce que le mécanisme de subvention de l'innovation au Québec est essentiellement de contribuer à la masse salariale. C'est-à-dire que vous, les payeurs de taxes, on entre bientôt dans cette joyeuse saison, contribuer généreusement à l'emploi des employés de Ubisoft. Mais encore une fois, il n'y a pas de politique de l'innovation véritablement. Il y a un investissement massif, mais il n'y a pas de réflexion véritable sur est-ce qu'il faut permettre aux entreprises subventionnées de retenir ce talent. Est-ce qu'il faut, au contraire, obliger l'employé qui est retenu dans une société créative, de circuler pour que votre argent, qui a permis la formation d'un employé spécialisé, qui a permis au cerveau de s'enrichir, d'enrichir d'autres lieux de l'innovation. Donc ces questions sont au cœur des réflexions sur les affaires Ubisoft. Première cause, une cause de 2006, Ubisoft divertissement contre Tremblay. Maître Tremblay a démissionné de ses fonctions chez Ubisoft le 28 mars 2006, c'est la trame factuelle, et a été embauché par un concurrent, Vivendi Games, à titre de président directeur général à Los Angeles. Il y a un coût réel à la clause de non-concurrence qu'avait signé M. Tremblay. Mais avant de voir ce coup-là, voyons les clauses qui lui étaient opposées et voyons aussi le discours, la narration derrière, la justification des clauses contractuelles qui forment ce verrou qui va contraindre l'employé créatif, ou en tout cas qui va contraindre l'employé qui a des responsabilités au sein du phénomène d'innovation et de la gestion de projets au sein de Ubisoft. Et le langage est particulièrement intéressant. C'est directement les clauses de Ubisoft qui sont citées directement dans le texte de la décision. Vu la nature hautement créative de l'entreprise, de la société, donc la nature hautement créative de l'entreprise est là pour justifier le mécanisme propriétaire. qui est, à défaut de pouvoir, en plus de s'approprier le travail intellectuel de l'employé, va le contraindre dans ses mouvements. Pardon. Vu la nature hautement créative de l'entreprise, de la société, de sa société mère et des autres sociétés qui leur sont apparentées, et des méthodes d'exploitation qu'elles ont développées à grands frais, il est de l'essence du présent contrat que Martin Tremblay s'engage au terme de chacune des clauses suivantes, sans quoi la société n'aurait pas contracté au terme des présentes. Condition essentielle, donc. Reconnaissance de la nature hautement créative de l'entreprise, des services qui vont être rendus, donc, et de la position de M. Tremblay au sein de l'entreprise. Et voilà maintenant la clause de non-concurrente qui suit tout de suite après et qui est citée par la Cour. Martin Tremblay s'interdit, à compter de la cessation du présent contrat, de travailler directement ou indirectement, pour son compte ou pour celui d'un tiers, dans toute entreprise fabriquant ou commercialisant des articles de jeux vidéo susceptibles de concurrencer ceux vendus, fabriqués ou développés par la société ou pour son compte, et ce pendant une durée d'un an sur l'ensemble des territoires du Canada, des États-Unis et du Mexique. Limitation quant au type d'emploi, donc conforme à l'article 2089 du Code civil, limitation quant à la durée de la clause, un an, et limitation quant au domaine géographique. Donc a priori, on est véritablement dans les conditions de l'article 2089 du Code civil, et en réalité, il va y avoir, la Cour va autoriser, va rendre une injonction interdisant M. Tremblay de travailler pour un concurrent. Ce qui est particulièrement intéressant, et c'est là où on peut peut-être discuter du coût de telle clause, c'est que le choix du nouvel employeur n'est pas anodin. Vivendi, en réalité, est situé à Los Angeles, en Californie, et le choix de M. Tremblay, conscient de ses obligations par rapport à Ubisoft, avait choisi d'accepter une offre d'emploi en Californie, car, je viens de vous l'expliquer, en Californie, ce type de clause est illégal. Ne peut donc pas être opposable à M. Tremblay. La déclaration qui est en preuve est ici, comme quoi il y a un lien direct avec ce que ont avancé les politologues. Le lien, l'impact des engagements contractuels sur la mobilité de l'emploi. Pour les tribunaux en Californie, cette clause est illégale. C'est le témoignage écrit qui a été déposé en cour. C'est pourquoi j'ai pu signer mon contrat. Et ce type de clause est illégal et n'a pas d'emprise en Californie. C'était la seule façon pour moi de m'en sortir. Trouver un endroit où la clause n'avait pas d'emprise, tel qu'il appert d'articles publiés sur Internet et dans divers journaux en liasse. Alors on peut s'interroger, c'est une cause québécoise, mais vous voyez que l'impact, l'employé est québécois, l'impact a été considérable pour M. Tremblay, il a été soumis à une injonction l'empêchant de travailler, il avait même mentionné qu'il y avait effectivement une clause pénale qui le condamnait au paiement d'une demi-année de salaire. Il avait mentionné à son employeur Ubisoft qu'il était prêt à payer, probablement avec l'argent de Vivendi, le concurrent. Mais il y a une véritable interrogation sur l'impact de ces clauses et un impact au niveau du droit international. Ce qui est intéressant également, lorsque la Cour va sanctionner et va imposer le contrat et la clause de non-concurrence à M. Tremblay, le fait que M. Tremblay ait eu des responsabilités d'administrateur et non pas de créateur a joué contre lui. On a cette obiter, ou en tout cas cette réflexion de la Cour qui est intéressante. Tremblay n'est pas un créateur ou un réalisateur de jeux vidéo. C'est un administrateur et un gestionnaire d'entreprise. En réalité, il était plus que ça. Il était directeur d'une des plus grandes franchises de Ubisoft. C'est-à-dire qu'il avait sous lui un jeu, comme par exemple Assassin's Creed, dont on va parler plus tard, et c'est lui qui gérait tout le développement du produit. Donc c'était, oui, un administrateur qui détenait un portfolio important chez Ubisoft, mais il était un élément important dans la mise en marché du jeu. Mais ce qui est intéressant, c'est que le fait qu'il ne soit pas créateur aux yeux de la Cour joue en sa défaveur. Il n'est pas créateur, ce n'est pas directement lié à son cerveau, c'est une habilité, une expérience d'administrateur, et cette habilité, il peut la répliquer dans d'autres industries. C'est ce que dit la Cour en accordant l'injonction demandée par Ubisoft. Autre cause, et là j'avais encore une belle image du directeur artistique de Assassin's Creed, qui est également un Québécois, qui a également travaillé pour Ubisoft. Cette fois-ci, on n'est plus dans le domaine de l'administration, mais on est dans le domaine de la création. Desilets, artiste québécois, est au sommet de sa gloire en produisant et en créant la série de jeux pour Ubisoft, Assassin's Creed, qui est une énorme franchise pour Ubisoft. Desilets est embauché, ou en tout cas il y a des appels, des offres qui lui sont faites par un autre studio qui vient s'installer à Montréal, THQ, qui est un studio concurrent à Ubisoft. Ubisoft également, et c'est encore une fois, c'est pas la seule cause que Ubisoft gagne, obtient à ce qu'une injonction soit rendue contre Desilets, l'interdisant de travailler pendant un an, avec les mêmes termes qui liaient également M. Tremblay. Donc Desilets est au chômage forcé pendant un an avant de passer sous la bannière de THQ. Ce qui est intéressant également, c'est le discours qui est tenu devant les tribunaux. Les individus qui composent la main-d'œuvre du studio de Montréal, de Ubisoft, sont de façon générale extrêmement spécialisés. L'entreprise les ayant embauchés dès la fin de leurs études et s'étant assurée au cours des années de leur formation et de leur développement professionnel. Comme si ça leur donnait un plein droit sur la créativité, comme si ça donnait un plein droit sur le cerveau de l'employé, permettant donc de créer ce verrou qui est la clause de non-concurrence. Et là, encore plus intéressant, la Cour se lance, on est au niveau de première instance, au niveau d'injonction, se lance dans une petite politique législative de savoir pourquoi, en plus, on est justifié à maintenir ces clauses de non-concurrence. La pénurie de talents rend le marché difficile, qui sévit actuellement dans l'industrie du jeu vidéo, est telle que Ubisoft, qui a été au cours des dernières années la cible de campagnes de recrutement directes, agressives et ciblées de la part d'entreprises concurrentes, notamment dirigées vers ses employés clés, a été contrainte de déployer des efforts considérables pour attirer des talents et retenir ceux qui sont à son emploi de manière à atteindre les objectifs de croissance qu'elle s'est fixés. Ah, il me manque encore des diapositives, mais c'est des diapositives surprises. La diapositive surprise, c'était que Ubisoft bénéficie d'un traitement fiscal de faveur depuis sa création jusqu'à maintenant. On est incapable, dans le volet fiscal de notre recherche, d'obtenir des renseignements sur l'état des comptes de Ubisoft. Tout ce que l'on sait, c'est que elle bénéficie très largement du financement québécois, notamment quant à sa masse salariale. Et encore une fois, on peut s'interroger sur cette question de rétention de talents, de l'investissement que Ubisoft fait dans ses employés, jusqu'à, j'allais pas dire les tenir en laisse, mais en tout cas les contraindre dans la firme, alors que c'est votre argent qui a en partie payé pour la formation de ses employés. Et à aucun moment on s'est interrogé à savoir s'il fallait rendre ou non ces subventions directes, conditionnelles, à ce que, par exemple, l'entreprise bénéficiant de subventions d'État quant à ses employés ne mette pas de clause de non-concurrence dans leur contrat à partir du moment où on décide, par exemple, qu'il y a un aspect positif à ce que la formation et l'expérience à l'intérieur d'une entreprise nourrissent également d'autres types d'entreprises. Alors, on s'interroge encore une fois sur cette question-là. Et puis, effectivement, on peut se dire, bon, est-ce que c'est vraiment si important que ça? Désilé, il n'a pas été très malheureux, il a probablement été payé par THQ. Est-ce que c'est véritablement là la problématique, la rétention de talent? Est-ce que ce ne sont pas finalement des incidents ou des incidences du droit? Finalement, on ne voit que la partie émergée de l'iceberg et ce n'est pas si important que ça. Mais c'est certainement assez important pour Ubisoft pour que quelques mois après, Ubisoft acquiert THQ pour acheter Désilets. Donc Désilets quitte Ubisoft pour le concurrent THQ et Ubisoft a les moyens financiers et la stratégie commerciale d'acquérir THQ pour se réaccaparer Désilets. Le dernier volet de la saga, c'est que Désilets, directeur créatif donc chez THQ devenu Ubisoft, déclare aux médias il y a quelques semaines qu'en réalité, ces projets créatifs ont été spoliés par Ubisoft et que le projet sur lequel il travaillait depuis une dizaine d'années a été accaparé par Ubisoft et qu'il ne veut plus travailler en lien avec l'entreprise Ubisoft. Et il a quitté THQ, désormais Ubisoft, pour monter son propre studio. Alors il y a un coût à tout cela. Je n'ai pas de solution ni de réponse à toutes ces questions, mais il y a un lien. Il y a un lien entre le coût de la clause de non-concurrence, de la politique d'entreprise. Il y a désormais des journaux, des articles, des études en administration et en économie qui démontrent que des entreprises intègrent leur façon de travailler de telle manière à ce que les employés n'aient pas connaissance de la totalité des projets pour empêcher qu'ils puissent revendiquer un quelconque droit sur ces projets, c'est-à-dire qu'ils divisent pour mieux conquérir. Et donc, il y a des éléments qui sont connus, qui sont intentionnels. Il y a, lorsqu'on négocie une clause de non-concurrence chez Ubisoft, il y a une claire politique d'appropriation, de rétention d'un certain type de créativité. Et puis les choses vont de mal en pis, en réalité. Ce n'est pas simplement les clauses de non-concurrence. Une fois qu'on tire ces questions de clauses de non-concurrence, on commence à s'interroger sur leur validité. Pourquoi en Californie elles ne sont pas valides et que la Californie est vue comme un domaine si actif? Pourquoi au Québec on ne s'est pas interrogé sur la mobilité de l'emploi alors que cet emploi technologique et innovatif est lourdement subventionné? Pourquoi finalement on ne pourrait pas imaginer une façon de mieux canaliser cet incroyable bassin de talent que l'on a à Montréal et ailleurs au Canada? Et on s'aperçoit que bien plus, ou en tout cas en parallèle avec la lutte pour la propriété intellectuelle, lutte pour l'enregistrement des brevets d'invention, lutte pour l'enregistrement des marques de commerce, il y a une véritable lutte pour les cerveaux. Et c'est ce que nous apprend la dernière enquête, la dernière saga qui a éclaboussé la Californie, où le département de justice de la concurrence a découvert que les plus grandes entreprises californiennes étaient impliquées dans un complot s'interdisant d'embaucher les employés de l'une et l'autre de cette entente. Donc il y avait une disposition, il y avait une entente, un complot, une collusion illégale entre les plus grands géants de l'industrie créative du moment, Apple, Google, Yahoo, pour en réalité créer de manière fictive une ossification du marché de l'emploi. Alors, il y a une vraie interrogation sur l'effet de la propriété intellectuelle, sur la relation avec le droit des contrats et avec le droit du travail sur l'impact sur la créativité, le rôle des employés dans l'innovation, on s'en occupe très peu. Le droit du travail est très rarement convoqué lorsque l'on réfléchit à l'innovation. On convoque la propriété intellectuelle, mais on vient de le voir avec Irène Calboli, avec Richard Gold, que la propriété intellectuelle n'a pas tous les outils pour encadrer ou pour faciliter ou pour s'adapter à une politique de l'innovation particulière. On voit donc que l'employé créatif ici, c'est probablement l'investissement de demain. Et c'est assez drôle parce que on retrouve c'est pas ma présentation, c'est une version antérieure, mais c'est pas grave. C'est intéressant parce qu'on retrouve ces préoccupations dans les années 50 en Allemagne. Et la petite histoire est la suivante. Peut-être que c'est dans les modèles étrangers que l'on voit notre propre futur. Dans les années 50, en Allemagne, on a très vite réalisé que le processus créatif était un processus organisationnel. C'est-à-dire que le processus créatif, le processus nécessaire à l'innovation, c'était d'abord et avant tout de s'intéresser à la corporation, à la structure corporative. D'où venait l'innovation à l'intérieur de la firme? Et l'Allemagne a été le premier pays à imaginer d'abord d'encadrer et de compenser l'employé inventeur. Alors, on est encore dans un cadre et d'une réflexion de l'innovation qui est très restrictif. Innovation égale invention, alors que innovation, c'est bien plus que l'invention. Mais déjà en Allemagne, on avait compris qu'à l'intérieur de la firme, il fallait reconnaître la contribution de l'employé, qui n'est pas simplement un salarié. Et c'est encore plus vrai avec les salariés artistes, qui, eux, supportent encore moins d'être dépossédés, un, de leur propriété intellectuelle, et de se voir dire de ne pas utiliser leur talent ailleurs, parce qu'ils risquent de tomber sous le coup d'une clause de non-concurrence. Et si je vous amène en Allemagne pour la conclusion de ces quelques réflexions, c'est parce que l'Allemagne est désormais un des modèles quant à la compensation des employés inventeurs. Il y a des mécanismes qui forcent l'employé, dès lors qu'il invente, mais le mécanisme pourrait être répliqué ailleurs, il pourrait être utilisé pour bien d'autres types de créativité ou de produits de création des employés. Il oblige l'employé à déclarer son invention. Mais on est en 1957. En termes d'innovation, on ne voyait que l'invention. Encore une fois, la portée de mes propos est bien plus large. Mais c'est simplement pour vous indiquer à quel point on peut être original en droit et qu'on peut s'inspirer de certaines solutions. Donc l'employé déclare son invention à l'employeur et l'employeur a 4 mois pour décider s'il va réclamer et revendiquer l'invention de l'employé. S'il ne fait pas, le droit à l'invention est conservé par l'employé. Libre à lui, l'invention est libre. Elle lui appartient. Si par contre l'entreprise décide d'opter pour l'invention, le coût de déposer l'invention, de faire les formalités, revient à l'entreprise. C'est un choix d'entreprise. C'est un choix stratégique d'entreprise. Il est forcé de déposer un brevet. C'est-à-dire qu'il y a une politique. Peut-être que ce n'est pas la bonne méthode. Peut-être que d'obtenir un brevet ne va pas augmenter la profitabilité de l'entreprise ou plus généralement du pays. Mais c'est un choix législatif. Le législateur allemand, en 1957, s'est dit, en forçant l'entreprise qui a un employé créatif à déposer un brevet, je le force à être innovant. Je le force à mettre un produit, à imaginer l'invention, la créativité de l'employé et de le transformer, de le traduire en produit, en marchandise. L'employeur qui décide de prendre cette option va devoir déposer un brevet et il doit également compenser l'employé qui reste employé. Aujourd'hui, la partie de compensation simplement concernant les brevets, ce mécanisme fonctionne uniquement pour les brevets d'invention créés lors d'un emploi. La moyenne de cette compensation par rapport au salaire des inventeurs, c'est 8% par an. C'est considérable. C'est-à-dire que les employés inventeurs qui ont soumis à leur employeur cette invention, que l'employeur décide de produire cette invention ou pas, parce qu'il y a un risque, toutes les inventions ne sont brevetées, d'abord, toutes les inventions ne sont pas brevetables, et deux, toutes les inventions brevetées ne sont pas exploitables. Le risque est encouru par l'employeur, mais la rémunération fait partie intégrante de la compensation est une partie intégrante de la rémunération. Et c'est assez intéressant parce que c'est 159 millions d'euros. Les chiffres ont été rendus publics l'année dernière. C'est 159 millions d'euros qui ont été donnés à des inventeurs en compensation. Ces 159 millions d'euros ont donné sur le marché 1,4 milliard d'euros de revenus. Et le mécanisme, la mécanique des rétributions des employés est simplement un élément parmi d'autres qui montre qu'il y a une intelligence particulière de la place structurelle, organisationnelle, sociale de l'employé dans une politique d'innovation. Et on n'a même pas commencé à réfléchir à ça. Et ce qui est le plus troublant, c'est cette masse considérable de subventions d'employés spécialisés pour lesquels on n'a pas imaginé de quelle façon ils allaient rendre, ces entreprises allaient rendre au gouvernement, à part embaucher, rendre à l'État l'avantage considérable qui leur a été accordé. Alors, je vous remercie. Il nous reste quelques minutes pour des questions. Sinon, vous n'avez pas le droit à votre trophée. Je vous regarde tous. Questions, réflexions, insultes. Je suis désolé, j'avais des très belles images, mais je vais les faire parvenir pour ceux qui veulent les images. Pas de questions. J'espère que vous avez aimé votre soirée. Je tiens à féliciter. Et à remercier professeur Calboli qui a voyagé, qui a fait le tour du globe pour vous, et puis mon ami et collègue Richard Gold pour ses propos absolument édifiants et éclairants. Et j'espère que chacun de vous allez devenir ambassadeur de certaines des idées que vous avez pu glaner lors de cette conversation, qui était plus un monologue. Mais en tout cas, à bientôt.